Hello, everybody. It's Liam.
I'm Michelle Heron.
And I'm Heather Hawley. We're the host of Crime Over Wine Weekly, a brand new show keeping you up to date on the latest news in the true crime world.
Every Sunday, we'll share our take on the cases that are making headlines because we know you want to know as soon as we do.
You can find your new true crime and wine obsession now, wherever you get your podcasts. Get ready for that big test with Study.com. Study.com offers learning materials and test prep, even LSAT study prep guides for all of my legal nerds listening. Unfortunately, there aren't any wine study guides, and believe me, I did check. Listeners can get 30% off their first 3 months of any subscription level using the promo code CRIMEOVERWINE. Again, that's promo code CRIMEOVERWINE, no spaces, for 30% off your first 3 months at Study.com. Learn faster, stay motivated, study smarter with our sponsor, Study.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Crime Over Wine, the only podcast with head-scratching true crime stories that are just better over a bottle of wine. I'm your host, Liam Collins, and this week we are picking things right where we left you all last week. And I hope we're still friends after I low-key did you all dirty last week, but we ended with a major cliffhanger in the disappearance of Johnny Gosch, a 12-year-old little boy who went missing on a paper route in West Des Moines, Iowa in 1982. So if you haven't listened to last week's episode, stop this episode right now and go back to listen to last week's episode. Otherwise, you will be totally lost. But if you're all caught up, let me remind you where we left off. When last week's episode ended, someone had just come forward with critical information about what had happened to Johnny, and he claimed to be directly involved in his kidnapping. And y'all, I wish I could tell you that that was the most unbelievable twist that happened in this case, but it's not even close. So let's dive right back in. Episode 61, part 2 of Crime Over Wine continues right now with some wine. All right, Megan, the wine we're drinking this week is, you know, getting darker, I feel like, the more I drink it, which is kind of interesting. How are you feeling about this?
No, I agree. And I just wonder if that's because of the case we're talking about, because it's pretty freaking dark. I'm excited to hear about the next twist. But yes, I totally agree. This is one of those that I feel like there are certain wines that taste, I would say, heavy at the beginning in the best way. And then they lighten up as you get to the bottom of the glass. And I am admittedly at the bottom of the glass. And so I will say, I do think it's lightened up and it becomes a lot more, I would say, doable. Like, it's very drinkable, this wine.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm getting, it's actually, like, it's sticking with me in the back of the mouth quite a bit. Actually, like, we talked about that lingering finish, and it definitely has lingered more so than I expected it to. But it's like a thick, because it's a much darker red, but it's you know, hanging on to, it's hanging on. The finish is hanging on a lot more than I expected. You know, when it comes to a lingering finish, I usually expect it to kind of like wash away after a while, but this is like hanging in there.
No, I
agree.
I need
to cleanse the palate, honestly, after every sip.
No, 100%, I agree. So there are some wines that I would describe as like crisp and quick. Yeah. And I would not describe this wine. This is a lingering, this is a heavy and like the best way possible. Like, you can drink it every 5 minutes and you're good to go.
Yeah. Well, and so, like, again, talking about the tannins that we're talking about, that is the tannins. That's like
where
the tannins is just going to coat the mouth, and that's how it's going to, it's going to stick around. That's kind of when you get a little bit more of that thickness, a little bit more of that intensity. That's because you got a lot of tannins going on. And so there you go.
And that's exactly how I would describe it. Like, it coats the mouth. So it's very tannin forward.
Yeah. There you go. Excellent. Well, Megan, as much as I love talking about wine, there's so much more to talk about here. We just need to move on, I think. And Megan, are you ready to hear about this guy? Because this is when things really start turning east.
Oh my gosh. Okay, I really am getting to the bottom of this glass, and I think I'm going to need it.
Oh, you're going to need another bottle, my friend.
Okay, perfect. I'll take that too.
So the man that we're talking about, Megan, his name was Paul Bonacci, and he was 23 years old when he came forward. Paul at the time was in jail serving time for child molestation, and during conversations he had with his lawyer, he admitted to playing a part in Johnny's kidnapping. Here's what happened, Megan. Paul claimed to be a victim of child sex abuse himself and claimed to have been sold into a child sex ring. A while into this horrific experience, Paul said he met a boy named Mike at a park outside of Omaha when he was just 15. Mike introduced him to a man named Emilio, who produced child pornography, and Mike and Emilio ended up inviting Paul on a trip to Iowa. The group stayed in a hotel on the west side of Des Moines when another man came into the room holding a bag full of photographs, and one of those pictures were of Johnny Gosch. When it became clear what the two men were trying to get Paul to take part in, he refused. But then Emilio took him down a dirt road with a gun to his head and told him if he didn't participate, he was going to, quote, blow his brains out. It was then when Paul agreed to participate reluctantly. Now, this is when it gets hard to hear, so brace yourselves, please. And if you are sensitive to crimes against children, I would really recommend skipping forward a few minutes. Paul said the men went down to the paper route, saw Johnny, and Paul got out to ask him a question. When a fifth man named Tony pushed Johnny into the car, Paul held chloroform over his face and they drove him out of town toward Omaha, Nebraska, and then a couple days later toward Sioux City after that. Paul and Mike were both ordered to perform horrific sexual acts on Johnny while they were filmed so that the videos could be sold afterwards. It apparently happened several times, but at some point Paul said he was driven back to Omaha while Johnny stayed in Sioux City, and just a few months later, Paul saw Johnny again when he was brought back to Colorado.
Okay, so Johnny's still alive at this point.
Yes, yeah. So this all happened within a couple of days after Johnny disappeared.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so this slightly answers one of the questions I had, which is whenever I hear about crimes that involve multiple perpetrators, a lot of times it's like couples that commit crimes together, but it's right. Like, you know, and this is a whole ring of people doing this crime. It's like, how do you find each other? Like, yeah. These people that have these desires and commit these acts, like how in the world do you, especially this is before social media, we're talking like 60s, 70s, 80s here. Right. Like literally, how do you find that there are people who have these same inklings? I don't know. Like, yeah. Oh babe, this is so bad.
Yeah, no, and again, gets even worse. Megan, but like and what kind of makes me think about like that question, Megan, is like it's how Paul got involved in all this. And it just seems like a lot of times anyways, from what I've kind of understanding about this whole situation, again, not an expert by any means, but it seems like it's like a lot of these people started off as victims themselves and like this is all they knew. And so then they like graduated, for lack of better words, into a perpetrator. And it just is like, it's, you know, they did it to stay alive. And then at some point it just kind of became a part of their life and they're more entrenched in it than they would want to be, or maybe they wanted to be to begin with. And now like they're stuck.
Oh yeah. Well, and that's the thing. And it's because I've seen other documentaries in terms of other rings and stuff. And it's like, and you kind of shut yourself down to kind of what you're bringing people into. And it's just a survival mode at that point, which I totally understand. Right. Like you're literally just trying to survive. But when I think of the actual perpetrators, not the people like forced into this, when I think of the perpetrators who somehow get some joy from this, I guess, I don't know, but it just blows my mind how they found each other.
Yeah. Well, and like a joy, like as much as like power, that's kind of what I think about. Like, again, it seems like it's just like they're involved. Involved in people who will pay for it and they have the money, and it's like it's just the authority that you have over people.
Okay, so how much of this did Noreen know, and what did she think about it?
Well, Noreen is of course horrified to hear that this may have happened to Johnny, but Noreen actually ends up believing this story that Paul is telling, so much so that she agrees to meet with Paul in jail. Noreen drove down with her PI and a news crew to the jail where Paul is serving time in Lincoln, Nebraska. Paul had no idea who was coming to visit him until Noreen was sitting right there with him face to face. Paul told Noreen the whole story and didn't hold back, and the more Paul talked, the more that she believed the story, and the more she cared about him, oddly seeing a lot of what she had feared had happened to her Johnny in Paul. Paul knew intimate details about Johnny. He knew that he had just bought a dirt bike to ride around the vacant lot near their house. He knew that he sometimes went to the yoga classes that his mom taught and that he liked to go to a Mexican restaurant after the classes. He even knew the specific name of the restaurant, too. He also pointed out a birthmark on Johnny's chest that was shaped like South America and the scar on Johnny's tongue from when Johnny fell from a treehouse and bit his tongue. He also mentioned that Johnny had a burn mark on his leg and knew it was from when his ankle touched the tailpipe of his older brother's motorcycle.
Okay, so this is what we know is Paul knew Johnny.
Right.
Okay, that's the basis of what we know. And I can understand from Noreen's standpoint, we want this to be a good thing in terms of he can provide information. He wasn't like an actual perpetrator. This wasn't, right. He didn't want this to happen. So she did this. She did this what? Outside of the police investigation? Did she tell police about this? What did they say about it?
I think she originally, if I remember correctly from reading about it, I think she like mentioned it to them in passing kind of thing. But like at this, so, and we're going to get to like how this all, like Paul's involvement with police and what like police, I'll just put it this way. Police knew Paul at this point. And so, and they had some questions about Paul.
Okay.
And so, but again, but if you keep in mind where Noreen's at in this whole situation, Noreen is not trusting police. And so, like, frankly, from what I've gathered from Noreen, it seems like if police says don't do this, Noreen's going to be like 10 times more likely to do it.
Fair.
And so that, so I think, so I don't, I, but I, she wasn't asking for their permission by any means. I'll just put it that way.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see.
And again, so I have to say, and it hold all this, all these thoughts for sure, because we're going to come back to once we get to know Paul a little bit more, because he's definitely not over. But it's important, I think, to kind of acknowledge that, like, you know, all these details about like all these things that he's saying about Johnny, I think like contribute to a really important thing. So
sure.
Definitely hold that.
Okay.
Well, okay. So like I said, Megan, so police had actually already known about Paul, interestingly, but they refused to interview him, even after Noreen told them this incredibly detailed and specific story afterwards.
Wait, they refused to interview him?
Correct.
But why?
Well, police said that they didn't see him as a reliable witness. Paul had previously been convicted of perjury from previous accusations he made about the high-level people he claimed to have been involved in this massive child sex ring, namely a man named Lawrence King. Now, everything Lawrence is accused of could be a whole podcast series on its own, but let me give you the cliff notes here, Megan. And I see your face.
Gosh.
Grab the glass.
I know.
Lawrence was the owner and the, you know, operator of the Franklin Community Federal Credit Union in Omaha, Nebraska, and was a rising political figure with deep connections to Washington, D.C., including all the way up to the White House. But there were several accusations that the credit union was just a front for embezzlement and was used to organize lavish sex parties where minors were sexually abused. He was also accused of having hundreds of photographs of the minors he's accused of trafficking, and at least one of those photos was said to have been of Johnny. Now, the accusations against Lawrence were found to be baseless by several grand juries, and as a result, Lawrence's accusers, including Paul, were indicted for perjury. But in 1991, the same year Paul Bonecci came forward to his attorney about his involvement in Johnny's kidnapping, Lawrence pled guilty to assisting in embezzling more than $39 million through the credit union. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison, and the credit union was in turn shut down.
Stop. Okay. Multiple things running through my mind right now. So something that, and I don't know if you address it, maybe not, but in this time, I'm also thinking satanic panic, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So mm-hmm. So this is when we're talking about, you know, daycare child sex rings, and it's just 100% not true. Like, is this just crazy embellished stories about high level people in the community? But then the second thought, which is he was convicted of embezzling $39 million, which in today's money, not do math. I do not know what we're going to times by.
It's
let's just say that's $100 million for funsies.
Sure.
That is quite the crime when you're in charge of this credit union Like, so in my mind, it's one thing to commit the crime kind of against the credit union using the credit union's resources, mm-hmm. but then to be in charge of it and use it to benefit yourself. That's my thing. And so I've got these two conflicting thoughts, which are, these are, you know, crazy accusations, because these are indeed crazy accusations. And they're coming around the time of satanic panic. But then on the other hand, we've got the conviction of embezzlement, but we've also got the conviction of perjury. So I just don't know who to believe. And I just need you to tell me who to believe, Liam.
Well, and let's be clear. So Paul and these other, accusers were saying that were making accusations and were charged for perjury specifically because of the child sex ring accusations, which Lawrence was, you know, completely exonerated for, or in fact, he wasn't even exonerated. He was just never charged with it.
Fair.
So there's that much. But like, then I also go to the point of like the original accusation was that he was using this money to embezzle, but then also using that embezzlement money to run this child sex ring, which like those two things, frankly, in my opinion, need to be mutually exclusive. Otherwise, what are you embezzling money for? Right. And so like, so I, so it just doesn't really sit well with me that like, okay, you don't believe that like the child sex parties are happening, but you do believe that he was embezzling money, but like what, for what purposes, you know what I mean? So it's like, you're going to like, you know, you're going to like, you know, go after him about this, about the money thing, but then also go after people who like, who are accusing him of like the whole operation. It feels weird, right? It just doesn't really make a lot of sense. And like, they could be victims if you believe the entire thing.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying is, because there are so many, I guess, facets of these accusations, because mm-hmm. there's embezzlement, there's child sex trafficking, there's all of these things. And so it's like, I mean, we could shut down one facet and we still have all these other facets to discuss. Right. And so is this the conspiracy you were talking about? I can't handle it.
Kind of.
Okay.
Kind of.
Oh my gosh, is there more?
There's a little bit more.
Liam!
This was definitely like the big nugget when it come down to the, to the conspiracy part of it. But like, so, but going back to like, again, like he's a high ranking, like he was, you know, described as a rising star within a political party. I won't name which political party because I don't want to go there. But like, look it up for yourself. But like the, but like point being is that like, so he was connected. And so it's like, how much do I actually want to like put stock into this? Because it's like, we know, like, again, we've seen it over and over and over again that like, the, you know, these people who are really well connected, like, don't, you know, don't have the same consequences as everybody else. So like, and like knowing all this, what had happened in hindsight, and like knowing a lot of things that we're going to talk about in a little bit, like, how am I to believe that everything's just honky-dory and like nothing actually happened?
Oh, totally. And well, and I think like a modern equivalent, and you know, the charges are different, but I'm thinking the Murdaugh trials are super interesting. Mm-hmm. A very well-connected guy pulled several levers to not be held responsible for this crime. And so, and you know, take that back, crimes, 30, 40 crimes. Yeah. I'm a bumblebee over here.
I'm obsessed with the Murdochs.
I know. I love it. So you take that back 30, 40 years when there's like less accountability and there's more kind of deference for authority. And
it's easier to hide.
Exactly. Right. And so it's just like, literally, who do you believe?
Yeah. Well, and also I go back to like, if Johnny's really involved in this in some way.
Yeah.
You know, tied to all this, like going back to Noreen, right? Where now it was, you know, it started off as like, let's take on, you know, our local police chief, and like, cause he's up to weird stuff. Now all of a sudden you're getting involved in the White House and like that kind of stuff. Like, this is like some high level stuff, and it's like, you're just a mom. Like, you should, like, nobody asked for this.
A grieving mom too. So it's like, yeah. So yes, you're a mom, and you're just like this small town mom. But then on the other hand, it's like, and so now you're grieving, you're trying to grieve what is probably the loss of your son, but then also hold out the hope that he's coming back. And then you hear all these stories about what could be him.
Right.
Potentially take a phone call that might be him. And so you're dealing with all of these emotions, and you're trying to take on the entire freaking system.
Yeah.
Right. I can't. Right. This woman.
Yeah. Well, you know, Paul had finally felt enough justification to come forward about what he had been through, but police continued to refuse to interview him because they didn't think whatever he said, you know, would be able to be used credibly in court because he had previously been convicted for lying under oath. But to Noreen, knowing the truth seemed to be enough. And according to Paul, Johnny was alive as far as he knew, which just felt better to Noreen than the information she had before, which wasn't all that much if you really think about it. But now she knew that her son Johnny was likely suffering out there. She feared he may still be in captivity, but being forced to do despicable things for powerful men. Or she thought he may be in hiding somewhere after possibly escaping from the hell she feared he may have been experiencing. It felt like every time she got new answers, those answers just led to even more questions. And for even more years, after the years that it took for Noreen to get to that point, she found herself just forcing herself to come to terms with the situation. There was nothing she could do about it. And by March 18th, 1997, she had been moving her life into a new direction. She had divorced from John, Johnny's father, when their new reality just wasn't conducive to them staying together, right? It was just too stressful and just too painful. So she moved into her own apartment, living on her own, and 15 years after Johnny went missing, she had moved away from the home where the front porch light always stayed on just for Johnny. And in the middle of the night, that night, Noreen was fast asleep, which rarely happened for her at this point in her life. That's when she was awakened to a knock at the door. She was terrified. By this point, her life was so public that she had been the victim of several ill-intended pranks and some straight-up threats, too. She looked through the peephole of her door to see two men, and one looked kind of familiar, but she couldn't really put her finger on, you know, where exactly she knew him. So she called out, "Who is it?" And one man replied, "It's me, Mom. It's Johnny." Crime Over Wine is proud to support Emancipet. Today, there are over 60 million beloved pets across the country whose families cannot access or afford veterinary care. With your help, Emancipet is changing that. Emancipet is a nonprofit that offers low-cost vet care for those who need it most. They rely on donations to keep their costs low for pet families across the country. You can support Emancipet's mission at emancipet.org. It had been almost 15 years at this point since Johnny went missing. He would have been 27 years old, but Noreen knew the second that that familiar-looking man responded back saying that he was Johnny, that it was indeed her little boy. She threw the door open, and immediately she could see into his vibrant blue eyes that it was him. She threw her arms around him, and she invited both of the men inside to talk. She told herself over and over again that this must be another one of her empty dreams, but this one just felt so real. She was so sure that this was her son truly standing right in front of her. Plus, every other dream for the last 15 years was of Johnny as the 12-year-old boy she remembered him as. This was him as the full-grown man she would expect him to be today. To prove it was him, Johnny opened his shirt to show off the birthmark shaped like South America on his chest. She didn't know the other man, and he didn't say much, but throughout the entire conversation, Johnny occasionally traded a glance with the man, clearly looking for his approval about what he could or couldn't say. Johnny looked to the man when Noreen asked him where he had been living, and the man just shook his head, clearly signaling to Johnny that he shouldn't tell her. Johnny did tell Noreen about how he was pulled from the street, lost consciousness, and woke up bound and gagged. The next parts of the story gave so much credence to what Paul had told Noreen about Johnny's disappearance 6 years prior in that jail in Omaha. Johnny said he woke up and Paul told him to do what they asked him to do and that he would be okay. He said he was locked in a basement for days until a man came to buy him from his kidnappers. From there, he traveled across the country being used to sexually compromise businessmen and high-profile politicians. Years later, he managed to escape, assumed a new identity, and he has been in hiding ever since. He said he wanted to come home, but he knew that doing so would put himself and Noreen in danger, and so he just stayed away until now when the time was right. He was only there for an hour or two, according to Noreen, but over and over again he assured her that if anyone found out that he had been in the apartment, that she would be killed. She offered to call her private investigator, but that visibly terrified him, so she backed down from that suggestion. Once he said he needed to go, he told his mother that the only way he was going to be safe was if his kidnappers were arrested and brought to justice. All of them. So we walked off with this man into the night again, and Noreen thought to herself that this would probably be the last time she ever saw Johnny.
Wait, okay, so he said, what, the only way he was going to be safe is if his kidnappers were arrested. So was he giving her right. information to do this?
No, not at all. In fact, very little information about to, like, actually do this. But, like, I think more so just saying, like, I think I kind of read that in a different way, Megan. I kind of read that actually as, like it seemed as though he was kind of saying that he probably would never be safe.
That's why I can't stay. I gotcha.
That's why you can't stay. Right. And so, like, the only, like, and just to, like, reiterate that, like, as long as they're out there, like, he's never going to be safe. And so it was just more so saying, like, I can't, like, there's no way, like, there's, it's too big kind of thing.
Okay. I'm literally pouring another glass. I don't know if you can hear it. Okay. So I am highly skeptical of these situations. And I'm very anxious to hear your opinion. I think the vast majority are people who don't have empathy, common empathy towards people and what they're going through. And they think it's funny and it's something that they can tell their friends. And that's why, you know, you said he was like, oh, he was visibly upset at this suggestion. Yeah. Well, that's because he was about to get found out that he wasn't the real guy.
Sure.
I am always skeptical of these experiences. What do you think?
I believe very strongly that I don't think it was a faker. I don't think that was the situation, only because based on what she says, like, first of all, that birthmark, right? Like, I mean, she saw that and immediately knew, kind of thing. Like, it just like felt right to her from that perspective. But he also knew so many details that, like, if you weren't Paul, like, you wouldn't know all this stuff. Like, it seemed like it was just checking all the boxes and matching everything all together in terms of, like, what he had been through, how he had been through it, what had happened to him over and over and over again. And so it just seemed like the stories kind of mashed together. And so if this was just, like, some strange man, who was taking advantage of a, you know, poor woman's situation, then, like, that took a lot of effort to do. And, like, but then at the same time, how did he know all this stuff too?
Okay, fair. And so when it came to the conversation she had with Paul, you said, I'm trying to remember, did she go to the police about it? Did she divulge that information? Was this ever publicly released? Was the birthmark? I mean, you can, like, I mean, and sure. This is, I'm just such a skeptic in terms of this mm-hmm. stuff. I mean, you can create what looks like a birthmark on your body. Like, was this information ever publicly released? That's my question.
Yes, it was, to be fair. And that's a valid point. I don't know if about the information that Paul shared with mm-hmm. Maureen, but I would imagine she mentioned it to police at this point, right? Because she said, hey, I talked to this Paul dude and, like, this is what he said. And, like, mm-hmm. the police were like, yeah, we don't believe him because of this perjury charge. And so there's that much, I could see what you're talking about the possibility of, like, you know, making up the birthmark, you know, or piecing together this whole information. But then why? Like, that's kind of my question. And, like, why would anyone do that? Like, why would anybody, you know, like, call in the middle of the day and pretend to be Johnny if they weren't, if indeed that wasn't Johnny?
I mean, fair, but. And I'm with you, like, but the other side of that coin, which I feel like carries the exact same weight, is the odds of it actually being Johnny. And he comes for a few hours and it's actually him, and, you know, he divulges all of this information. I mean, it's the odds. That's what I'm saying, is that's insane. Because how did he find her?
Right. That was the other thing. That was the thing that, like, made me believe that, like, how the heck is this even possible? Because she moved, right? Like,
right.
And so, like, how was he gonna, unless these people were, like, that connected that he was able to, like, figure it out, or, like, they, like, maybe he, like the people that were holding him hostage were able to, like, you know,
I guess get a hold of a phone
and, like,
book.
Hold it over him.
Like,
yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I mean, the Yellow Pages back in those days.
Sure, 1997. Yeah, I mean, I guess I could believe that. But yeah, that was my thing too. Is that, like, how did he track her down when, like, he was, like, literally in held in captivity for the past 15 years?
Yeah.
But so my theory on that front was, like, more so that, like, she was just dreaming this whole thing.
Oh,
because again, it happened in the middle of the night, and, like, it just seemed like all these things were kind of matching together. And, like, think about, like, all of the times that, like, That like these dreams came to her, and it's just like the stress, like you've had those dreams, right?
Very
where, like,
fair.
You wake up and you're like, is this real or is this fake? And especially with this kind of terror, like I've had night terrors before that feel so real that you're like feel like it's happening. And like it very well could have been a situation where it was just like she convinced herself that this actually happened.
I mean, that's a fair point. Maybe she had one too many glasses of Vivir Sin Dormir wine. Mm-hmm. And
sure.
We had some subconscious thoughts playing out here. That's honestly, I didn't even think about that. But I mean, especially when you're at a situation when your reality is so bad that it literally feels better to believe a fantasy. I get it, and I don't blame her at all. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and especially too when like that like nightmare is playing out.
Yes.
Day in, day out for 15 years, like the kind of stress that plays on your mind, I can't imagine.
Yes.
Like, I can't imagine how many times, like, she has probably played that moment out in her brain so many times that, like, it just, like, this just felt more real than all the times that she imagined it. So, like, maybe that was just why, that it was, like, it just felt better, you know, than the other times. Which, again, that's a total theory. Like, she's very much so as adamant that this was him. So, like, you know, I put as much stake into that as possible that, like, if she says it was him, then, like, let's believe it was him. And believing a dream doesn't really do us much good, right, in the long run in terms of finding Johnny.
No, I mean, from an investigation standpoint, it doesn't do us any good. But honestly, from an emotional standpoint for her, if that's what needs to happen, then go off, queen. Like, believe it. I'm with you. Yeah. Okay, so she has all of this. So this whole experience, what did she do with it? What did she do with that information?
Well, she actually held onto it for a few days, Megan. She thought about going to the police right away, but her faith in law enforcement, was pretty much gone at this point.
Fair.
It died a long time ago.
Yeah.
And she even theorized that someone in the department may be connected somehow to Johnny's kidnapping. Eventually, she did share the story with her PI, Johnny's father, and to some investigators who she trusted more than others, but it was clear that most people just didn't believe her. I mean, as a mother, how could she have her little boy breathing the same air as her and let him go? Johnny's father even cast some doubt publicly over whether the story was legit or not. Even today, investigators assigned to the case won't come out and say one way or the other whether they think the story was true. I mean, but like, also, how do you even verify that sort of thing anyways?
Okay, wait, so his father, and we're talking about the story of Johnny coming with his, whatever it is, his handler or whatever, he's casting doubt on that story?
Yes, correct. Yeah, John says that he's, and like, to be clear, it was the same kind of like, you know, like answer, non-answer of like,
sure,
we're not sure, like, you know, and like, he definitely, like, based on what I read about it, it seemed like he was definitely leaning more on the side of like that this didn't actually happen. So that's kind of the, you know, how it's being received.
You know, I think that's really interesting because he saw her in her best and her worst lights. And he can kind of make that composite of what he thinks probably the end result is. I would be really interested in hearing more about what he, kind of like his view of A, everything that happened, and B, Noreen's response to it. Because there is, I mean, coping mechanisms are real, my friend. It's like, I have coping mechanisms for my life, and I don't have a missing child for 15 years.
Yeah, no, so true.
Yeah, and so it's like, what is our psychology doing to us just so we can survive our day-to-day? And he might have some really interesting insights. That's all I'm saying is I'd be interested in how he, as an objective, like, outside party, viewed everything that was going on and her responses to it.
Yeah. Well, and again, so they had divorced, you know,
yes,
I would imagine, in large part due to what they were going through with Johnny. And so so I don't know how ugly that divorce ended up being, or if it was ugly at all, or if they just like went their separate ways kind of thing. And so I would be curious to know if you know, like how their relationship was, because if it's like ugly, like, I don't really believe a word that John says,
fair,
in my opinion. But if it's, you know, pretty amicable, like, maybe there is some, you know, weight to that to a certain extent.
Very fair. Good point.
Well, that was the last that Noreen would ever see of Johnny, if that did indeed happen. And after that story went public, the horror only continued and the odd circumstances only got worse. In September of 2006, Noreen found an envelope on her doorstep with three photos inside. The photos were of several boys who were tied up, and one looked just like Johnny. Now, police determined that the photos were tied back to a group of friends in Florida who were playing a really cruel prank, but Noreen isn't so convinced. She finds that much so hard to believe because the picture that she thought to be Johnny was just too identical to her little boy. Here, Megan, here, I'm going to show you the picture. You kind of tell me for yourself what you think. This is the picture that she gets.
Mm-hmm.
So, odd. There's a cat in the background. I don't really... That's
what I was going to say. An adorable pet in the background.
Right. And, like, he seems pretty well kept.
Well, so that's what I was going to say is if somebody were to tell me this were, like, very creepily posed, I'd believe it. Because there's no, in my opinion, I don't see fear in the eyes. I see truly a pose. And so for everybody listening, it's... Again, I'm not a mother. I'd say this kid's probably like 12, 13-ish, blonde hair.
Yeah, 14. Somewhere around there, yeah.
Yeah, so his arms are tied behind his back. His legs are bound. He's got a gag in his mouth. And he's kind of got his head cocked to the side. And he's just looking at the camera. But again, like I said, I don't see a whole lot of like fear or angst on the face.
Emotion.
Yeah, it's a very interesting picture. And so you're saying that Noreen says that this is... Johnny.
Yeah, she says that it looks just like him. And so this is also the a picture of Johnny, just so we can get it kind of for yourself. This was him right before he went missing.
Oof. I mean, it's tough because little blonde babies look all the same, right?
Yeah.
Like,
well, and here's another one too, just so we can get a good feel for it. It does look like him.
That's what I was going to say. Now that picture for everybody listening at home, we've got... I mean, he's probably like, whatever, 5'4", blonde hair. I mean, just you're very stereotypical. We've got an Adidas shirt, all the things. Yeah. I mean, everything you would assume. But okay, I mean.
Yeah. Well, and we're going to put all these pictures on our social media pages too, so everyone can go check those out and kind of see it for yourself. But I mean, it does look kind of like Johnny, like a couple years older. But to that point, though, like it just doesn't feel... It doesn't feel right.
So this is my thing. If this is supposed to be from multiple years after he was abducted, he looks very well kept.
Right.
You know, he's been
exactly.
Showered and trimmed and all of these things. It's super interesting.
Yeah, but then also too, I mean, like, not to get too graphic into this, Megan, but like he was used, like if you think about what he was done for, like, you know, if he was like dirty and stuff like that, probably wouldn't sell well, unfortunately, for these, you know, for the perverts that we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
And so like it doesn't necessarily surprise me that he is like this well cleaned, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Like it like as good, knowing how he was used.
I mean, and that's a great point. And I will say that I love talking about like first impressions and essentially what are called mental heuristics. And that is just the shortcuts that the brain takes in terms of first impressions. And one of those is the brain loves to find patterns in things.
Right.
And so when we see somebody so me personally, I'm a twin, I'm an identical twin. And so people see me and they think they're seeing somebody else. And so the odds in terms of the amount of people who are in this world and, you know, she sees a picture and it looks, let's say 85% like her son would have looked at a certain time. And so her brain is creating those connections and connecting dots that really aren't there. And that's my first impression from a psychology standpoint, of which I am not a major and truly just love reading articles about. But, and it's that's what I'm wondering is like, I see based on the pictures, I totally see what you're saying, but I also understand how the brain works and how when we want to create connections, they just
kind of
all of a sudden appear.
Yeah, well, and I also have to imagine too, because of all these situations that have happened that seem too good to be true, like I'm wondering like how many times she's gotten these weird envelopes.
Right.
That like, you know, that maybe seemed less believable. So like maybe this just seemed more believable than the rest of them, like seemed to be the most believable envelope that she got to the house. Like that phone call seemed to be the most believable phone call that she had received. You know, that, you know, the person who came to her or to her home seemed to be the most believable, you know, person that came to her home throughout this whole process. And then also too, like, again, I go back to like the things that she's going through. Like, her brain is tired. It has to be at this point. And just like, it's possible it's just playing tricks on her at this point. And too, like, again, I have to kind of go back to like the hysterical mom, right? Like, that's how, you know, like, investigators have to be looking at her at this point. It's just like, you know, someone who's just trying to make something out of anything. That's probably how they're looking at her. And so like, I kind of like, how much do you put into either of them? I don't know.
Oh, totally. I mean, without like actual concrete evidence, I mean, you're right. Like, in a traumatized brain, I would say the most believable, there's just that the line gets blurred between the most believable and actually believable,
right?
Because this brain just wants the relief of the stress of, is my child still alive? Is my child dead? Let's find an answer. And so it's like, oh, well, it's obviously more enjoyable to believe that they're alive, even if they've had this horrible existence up until this point, at least they're not dead. And so,
right.
I 100% agree. It's like, maybe this is the most believable, which is still not an enjoyable existence to imagine, but it's still better than imagining that they're like not here anymore.
Right.
But so psychologically, I literally, first of all, cannot imagine what she's going through. But second of all, have no desire to pontificate on actually what's going on. I see where the connection could be made, but I also can see where there's a disconnect between, like, again, what are the odds? I mean,
yeah.
What are the odds in this case? How many years later?
Is it the most believable, or do you just want it to be the most believable, right? I mean, it really could go either way. But, you know, again, either way, investigators never gave this lead much credence once they got this call from this investigative agency in Florida. Today, Noreen still has her own personal investigation into Johnny's disappearance open for herself. She has named more than half a dozen alleged perpetrators or potential suspects, but none of them have been arrested today. Among those suspects are a man named Wilbur Milhouse, who in 1982 was high up working for the Des Moines Register, where Johnny delivered papers. Wilbur pleaded guilty in 1987 to sexually abusing teenage boys, but Noreen said that police did indeed check him out, but they were able to confirm that he was out of town the day that Johnny went missing. Today, investigators say they have found no link between Wilbur and Johnny's case, but are also not comfortable ruling him out completely. But he died in 2015, so any information that he may have had about Johnny died with him.
Okay, so was he ever investigated, Milhouse?
He was looked at as a suspect
for
a while, or a person of interest at the very least. But again, they never, so they looked into him enough to know that he had this alibi that he was out of town.
Okay.
But to that point, though, too, you know, they specifically said they never ruled him out. And even to this day say that they're not comfortable 100% saying that he wasn't involved.
Sheesh.
But definitely aren't willing to point the finger at him 100%.
Okay, so refresh my memory. I know that Paul, because he was convicted of perjury, was not considered a reliable witness. You said they never interviewed him?
Yep.
Okay, so this is my thing. You've got Milhouse, you've got Paul. So whether or not they're reliable, if they've got information that can be validated, that you can pull from so that maybe you can believe other factors of the story, and even if you don't like put them on the stand, but it leads you to these other things. The Paul never being interviewed slash investigated is insane to me. Milhouse, again, for the time, 1987, in charge of a business. I mean, I'm not too surprised, not saying that it's right.
Oh, not just a business, the business that Paul, that
exactly,
that Johnny worked for.
Like, yeah. Again, this is, if you were presenting this to me as like a movie script, I would, in 2024, I would tell you, Liam, this is too kind of like on the nose. Like, I would not believe this, because I, having full faith in current day police departments, which might be unfounded, would say that, oh, there's too many plot holes here. But I don't know, back in the 1980s, I feel like this really did happen all the time. There was no sharing of jurisdiction information. There was, you know, there was actually like this kind of like headbutting between jurisdictions. And then there really was this hierarchy, and you had to, like, if information did not conveniently fit between the hierarchy, then it apparently didn't exist. And so it's like, we hear all of these stories. And so 100% believing in where all of this information is falling through the cracks. But on the other hand, it's just like, holy moly, really? Like this conspiracy? Yeah. I mean, you use the word conspiracy, and that's exactly what it is. Like, it almost sounds too much. Like, it is just too obvious.
Right. Well, and it's either like the biggest conspiracy ever or the worst conspiracy ever.
Right? Because
it's like,
fair.
It's either like this, everyone's involved, or like everyone who isn't involved is just like too ridiculous to be doing their jobs. Frankly, to allegedly be doing their jobs, right? And so it's like all these people, it's like this police chief who's just a freaking, like, you know, horrible human being, it sounds like. So there's like him, and there was like, you know, these this officer who's doing weird stuff. It's like this, you know, it's like all these people who are just, you know, messing with it just enough to leave this like big fat freaking open circle right where we need it. We need that to be filled.
It's true. And also something else that I think speaks against the conspiracy theory is, at this point we're talking decades later. And you might prove me wrong on this literally in the next sentence, who knows, but there's nobody that's come forward who's been like burned by the police department that says, you know what, actually chief police such and such asked me to cover up this fact or something like that. And so, the necessity of a conspiracy is multiple actors keeping quiet. And so the fact that nobody's come forward, it's like, I mean, maybe the conspiracy theory is a little unfounded. Who knows?
Sure. Well, but I think there's like a giant, like, you know, I think to that, you know, counter that, I suppose, like it could be like, if we're talking about a conspiracy with like really powerful people, like all these people who are like deeply connected to all these worlds, like we're talking about positions that are, you know, that may not be directly connected to really powerful people, but could be like one degree of separation from powerful people. And like, that's how you create a conspiracy, right? When like one powerful person, you know, has like, you know, I think about like, you know, mobs, right? Where it's like, it's you have that one big powerful guy who's really nothing without all these different people in the exact right places and with the exact right connections to create this giant conspiracy. That's what this is kind of giving potentially, if we're to believe this big giant conspiracy, because we're with all these people. The police chief, the writer of the newspaper. It's like all these different people who, you know, traditionally, especially back in the 80s, you know, had very, you know, like very authoritative positions locally, and maybe had, you know, very authoritative connections to people who had, you know, very authoritative figures regionally. And then, you know, and then you had those connections nationally. So I'm reaching here. I know this, Megan, but like, that's where I'm going with the conspiracy.
No. And I love it. And I'm just telling you, as a Midwest girl, we can't keep secrets. We love tea. If one of us knows a conspiracy, then we all know a conspiracy. And that's like my biggest, I'm not going to call it a complaint. That's my biggest rebuttal against the conspiracy theory, is that a Midwest woman loves a conspiracy. So we would not keep our mouth shut.
Thing. Megan just solved this entire thing.
Guess I figured it out. It's fine.
Yeah, figured it out. There you go.
What's our next case, Liam?
Well, yeah, right. Well, I have another theory for you before we get there.
Okay, perfect.
And there's a little bit more to discuss.
Okay.
Here. So another theory that we're talking about comes from a possible colonel in the military. Now, this is particularly interesting to me because if you know, we didn't mention this before, but in both the conversations that Paul and Johnny had with Noreen, allegedly, they both reportedly told her about a man who was high up in this child sex ring, you know, conspiracy. If, you know, sorry to use that word around you, Megan, but who they only referred to as the colonel.
Oh, shit.
But this colonel had been accused of kidnapping and sexually assaulting a child as part of a major scandal at, Megan, the Presidio Army Base Daycare Center. But he was never criminally charged. This theory that connects this colonel suggests that he may have also used military resources to transfer the children involved in this sex ring across the country to these big sex parties.
Okay, so you've now, I'm totally turning around here, because military people can keep secrets. Okay.
Right.
Okay, so now we're talking about somebody in a position of authority and keeping secrets. Okay, I'm convinced. This is so interesting. Okay, so the guy was called the colonel. Mm-hmm. And we know who this guy is because he was accused of other horrible acts, right?
Right. I left him out. Yes, I left him out because he was never convicted of anything.
Okay.
I left his name out, so that's why I didn't mention him specifically. Sure. But he was high up in the military. No one ever, like, Paul and Johnny never specifically mentioned his name in those conversations. But again, they only called him the Colonel.
Okay. So, well, we know that Paul was never even investigated. Was anybody asked about the Colonel?
So not beyond the accusation. So they, like, investigated this whole thing and, like, didn't find that he did anything wrong.
Wow.
They never, like, they may have, like, you know, had him on the list, but they never specifically said that, like, he was a suspect, never said that he was a person of interest, etc. And they definitely didn't charge him with anything related to this.
Okay. I mean, yeah. I'm interested.
Well, and to be clear, like, the only reason that they made this happen was because of this scandal at this daycare center that he was accused of, and so therefore connected him to this, like, much larger, you know, situation specifically because of this Colonel thing, but, like, right. Also because of the accusations, and this may just be, you know, part of, like, the rumor mill kind of thing, but, like, then that led to, you know, using military resources, transferring children across the country, you know, involved in these big sex parties, etc.
Okay, yes, and I will also say, I don't see a date associated with this guy, but if we're talking daycares, if we're talking, like, the 90s, we are talking Satanic Panic, Rebecca's Story, all of that stuff. So I do have some red flags just, like, popping up a little bit, but then we've also got some green flags over here, like, oh, I'm telling you, military people know how to keep a secret. Right. Okay. Right. Okay. Tell me more. I need to know more.
Yeah. Right, right. Well, so that's not even all, Megan. There's one more thing I feel like I have to tell you. Because as part of this big feature on Johnny's case, a reporter for CNN named Thomas Lake last year in 2023 actually found Paul Bonacci, who reluctantly agreed to speak to Thomas on the record. Paul said when Thomas found him that police had still never questioned him about Johnny's disappearance. And when Thomas asked Paul about Noreen's story about Johnny visiting her back in 1997, Paul said that he knew that that had happened because Johnny told him about it the next time that he saw him. Paul said that Johnny was alive the last time that he checked, a few years before Thomas found him. He would have been about 53 at that time, and Paul said he had a family of his own. And with all of this uncertainty surrounding this whole scandal, Thomas asked Paul for proof about his story, and Paul replied saying that any proof he would have had was destroyed in a flood just a few years prior.
Okay. I love a good happy ending, so I'm not poo-pooing on this story. It would be great if Johnny were alive and he had his own family and happily ever after, but the convenience of a flood, I will say, from the Midwest, it happens. Yeah. We got tornadoes, we got floods, we got right. all the things.
And we got all the natural disasters.
Yes, we are cursed. So I'm interested in A, you know, where that happened, but B, it also does seem really convenient. On the other hand, I mean, like, this stuff does happen to, whatever, thousands of right. people a year. But the fact that he wouldn't have one more piece of evidence.
He doesn't have anything in it. Like, nothing got saved.
Like, that's literally kind of, like, nothing.
You know, right.
I don't know.
And, like, and again, to be clear, like, when we're not just talking about, like, you know, Paul's story about, like, you know, Johnny, you know, moving on and, like, Johnny, you know, how, like, you know, going to see, you know, Noreen in 1997. We're talking about, like, proof that, like, any of this had ever happened. Like,
yeah.
Him being kidnapped, him going into the child sex ring, him meeting Johnny, none of it. He didn't have any proof that anything happened. And so this is all just going off of his word. And, like, again, going back to what police had said, that he wasn't really all that reliable because of the perjury thing, like, sure. But I also go back to, like, the he knew intimate details about Johnny. Like, he knew things that, like, nobody else knew, and, like, Noreen was sold. So, I mean, what, like, what's, like, what do you say? You know, like, what do you, like, how do you weigh that between those two things? You know what I mean? Like, you at one point, like, say, like, yeah, there's so much going on, but at the same time, like, you can't prove any of it. Like, even the things that you know so clearly, like, who knows?
It seems really convenient that one person who needs to know this information also knows the information that, you know, evidence that would confirm all of it was destroyed. And
right.
I don't know. It just seems, Paul seems to be a very, like, a fount of information in some respects, but then mm-hmm. not in other respects. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, so to be clear, when I was talking about the flood, like, we were talking about, like, a flood at Paul's house kind of thing. So, like nothing that, like, Johnny...
Wait, so it was in his house?
Yes, correct.
Oh,
yes.
Shit.
So Paul, I guess, had all these things, all these pictures, whatever he had.
No way.
Everything was gone in Paul's house because of how unbelievable or because of how, you know, teetering we are on believing, you know, Paul or not believing Paul. Like, it seems like we should like the evidence would be a convenient thing to have,
right?
You know, from this whole thing. And it's like Paul would be the person to be able to do that, right? Because
Paul yes.
is the only person talking at this point. Paul seems to be the closest person to this whole thing at this point, and Paul doesn't have the stuff, you know. And
yeah.
on the other side of that coin too, right? Like, what if Paul is just at this point, like, not you know, not in a place to like to trust people, like, some, like, maybe the evidence didn't get destroyed, like, maybe you know, again, this is like going down a real long rabbit hole here, but, like, hear me out. Like, you know, I wouldn't put it past Paul to make that up if he did. I don't know, again, this is just Liam theory here, you know, just because who's he gonna trust, you know what I mean? And like, and this is just what he says, just to make it all go away, you know. It's been 40 years at this point.
Okay, fair. Because Paul, again, he was convicted of perjury. And so probably, according to his story, it was not perjury. The system was stacked against him and people in authority were creating this story. Okay, so I mean, I get it. If the perjury charges were fake, then I get why he would question, I mean, honestly, right. almost everything at that point.
Yeah, and especially because if we're to believe that, you know, that Paul actually was telling the truth about this whole situation, then he was telling then he was perjured because he told the truth about, like, the most traumatic thing that could ever happen to him. You know what I mean? And so it's like you can see how he can distrust people is the point.
Well, and that's always the case, I feel like, when you hear... This is horrible and no judgment, but it's like, I feel like you always hear these cases of, you know, they're questionable people, but they've seen behind the scenes. And it's just like, I mean, is that really how it always goes? It's never a trustworthy person, like an upstanding member of society who sees all this information. But honestly, when you think about it, probably not. And so Paul very right. well could be a witness to all of this and truly right. the person who could prove or disprove all of it. But I am curious as to what evidence, like, because if it's destroyed in a flood, then it's physical. And so
right.
it would what be video, written? All I'm just so curious as to what actual evidence that would be.
Yeah. Pictures seem to be coming up a lot.
Fair.
In these cases, but, like, yeah, I don't know. I can't imagine, like, water destroying pictures that much. So yeah, I don't know. Yeah, so that's a good point though. And, like, I don't know. Yeah, it feels so on the, like you said, it feels too on the nose that, like, all and like talk about, like, the, like, how this investigation has had the worst luck from the
very beginning,
where it's like, you know, John, you know, just happened to not want to, you know, to go on the paper route, and then it's like all these people just, you know, assumed that everything was going to be okay and, like, you know, let Johnny go off on his way, and then it was like all these people, like, you know, not, like, right there, and then it was, you know, the police chief may have had some bad things going on, and then it was like Noreen, you know, no one really trusted Noreen. No one trusted Paul. Like, no, like, all these things over and over and over and over and over again. And it's like, and then a flood, you know what I mean? And so it's like, what, like, when is, like, there has to be something out there that actually went right in this case, assuming that all this stuff, you know, really played out the way it did.
No, 100%. And that's where Noreen's story, I feel like it's almost like, to a certain extent, you can believe incompetence in the police department. You can believe a little bit of coordination between him and some city officials, but it comes to a point where there's a line of like legitimate conspiracy that the average brain, not my brain, because I do love a conspiracy and I'm totally down for it, but I'm just saying the average brain in terms of public opinion and, you know, bringing a case against it is probably going to tune out in terms of, like you were talking about.
This feels too much like a movie.
Exactly. Yeah. Like these, all of these plot holes, not believable. I'm down for it. That's, I mean, I want to make that very clear. I'm totally down for it. But in terms of trying to like plead her case, at some point she's almost discrediting herself by all of the holes in the process.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Yeah, no, that's totally fair. And it's easy. And like, again, I just feel bad for her even more if she's telling the truth of this whole thing, that like all these people just seem to just not believe her at all when she's, you know, at the same time grieving her son. It's just, it's horrible. It's just very, you know, it's just really hard.
Totally. And to be clear, I think she believes that what she's saying is the truth. And I think the brain will do as much as it can to keep you from believing the worst case scenario. And so, and this is what I think is happening, whether or not it's true or not. She thinks that there's a good reason to believe all of these things happened. And so I don't think that she is actively lying, but I also think the brain is really good at keeping us from envisioning and truly believing the worst case scenario.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Well, you know, as unbelievable as this whole story may sound, it was all way too real for Noreen. Today, she has become a tireless advocate for child victims of sexual abuse. She said she has spoken to more than 100 people who have suffered in the same way Paul and Johnny did. 6 of those said that they saw and knew Johnny while they were in captivity together, and even shared some of the same intense and intimate level of detail as Paul did to confirm that they were indeed also telling the truth. Paul told that reporter for CNN that Johnny knew his mother had been helping so many other people like him. He even sent some of them to her, knowing that she would be willing to help them. But he said he wasn't willing to come forward until he knew for sure it was safe, and he still doesn't feel like it is even today. More than anything, as Noreen said in that CNN story, Noreen just wants Johnny to know that she tried. She went on countless TV programs, demanded action from police, wrote to President Ronald Reagan to beg for help, and helped pass Iowa's Johnny Gosch Bill in 1984, which ensures that police don't have to wait to start looking for missing children. It requires them to begin investigating right away when a minor is involved. And today, that law is the gold standard in states across the country. Her actions led directly to the creation of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which provides a database for missing children and promotes advocacy work around the most vulnerable victims. And although he was the first boy on the milk carton, he wasn't the last. Hundreds of young boys and girls have been featured on milk cartons ever since as one of the most successful campaigns of investigative measures in the history of true crime. Johnny would be 53 today, but Noreen said it is still hard to imagine him as anything else besides her 12-year-old boy. And there is still justice to be had to close that book for good. So if you know anything about Johnny Gosch's disappearance or the involvement of anyone who may have had a hand in his abuse or any other young child's abuse in this, you know, potential conspiracy, call the FBI in Des Moines, Iowa at 515-223-4278 because it's never too late for justice to be served.
It's so true. And this is how it happens, right? Decades out. A story that was told and passed on, or somebody who thinks that, you know, the statute of limitations has run out, or, you know, the consequences won't be as bad right now. Like this is how it happens, is these random stories, you know, a breakup and a boyfriend and a girlfriend break up, and then the girlfriend goes and says, well, actually, or marriage, you know what I mean? This is how it happens. And it's these little tips that make the biggest difference. And the fact that this is still a cold case, oh my gosh, my heart goes out to Noreen.
Yeah. Right. Well, and like to that point too, right, where it happens when, you know, that little detail seemed too little to talk about 100 years ago, but then you think about it today and you're like, you know what, maybe I will, because it just didn't feel right, but like I'd kind of push it off because it didn't really seem like it was that big of a deal. But that may have been the thing that, like, you know, that set things into a direction, you know, help people make an arrest, help people find Johnny. And so that's why, you know, it's so important to see something, say something. That's why it's so important that if you see a stranger walking a little too close to a woman on the street, call 911, right? Like, you know, again, like I would do it again. So point being is that, like, it's you know, like you said, it's not, like we said before, it's never too late for justice. It's never too late to do this. And it's never too late for this to be turned into something like decently positive, right? Like, think, like, I just listed all those things, and like I had to leave some out just for the record of like ways that Noreen like really like pushed and pushed and pushed, and like think about all like how many children's lives have been saved potentially because of the Johnny Ghosh bill that was signed into law, or you know, or because of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which as far as I'm concerned is the freaking Lord's work.
Yes.
And so like thinking about this on the back end, I mean, this is, you know, it sucks, if that's the way that you want to put that word, that that whatever happened to Johnny had to have happened to him for like all these, you know, amazing things to happen, but at least they did, you know.
Oh yeah, I mean, at least something can come from it. Oh my gosh, 100%. And may we all have a little Noreen inside of us that makes the best and literally changes the world based on the worst thing that can happen to us.
Right, absolutely, yeah, without a doubt. I say that is all that we have for you this week, but we've been talking for almost 2 hours, Megan. And so, like, I don't really think that, like, that is fair to say, frankly, because we talked about this is a action packed freaking episode.
Insane.
But I'll just say, Megan, thank you so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure seeing you. But it's a pleasure having you as official member of the Crime Vineyard now.
Babe, I am so honored and I'm so happy to raise a glass and drink some wine on Crime Over Wine, and I can't wait to come back.
Amen. Oh, if you're already talking about coming back, you must have had a great experience the first time.
Girl, please.
I love that about you.
You know.
You are the queen of social media as far as I'm concerned in Chattanooga, so tell everyone where they can find you and your work online.
Yes, so I am very uncreative. My Instagram handle is just the Megan McLean on Instagram, so it's just T-H-E and then M-E-G-A-N, M-C-C-L-A-I-N. I am a business owner. I'm a real estate agent. I'm all the things. I like to share funny things because we've got so many other things going on in our lives, but thankfully it's not that our children have disappeared. So I am no Noreen, but I do just like to have a good time. So yeah, if you guys want some good stuff online, just go ahead and give me a follow.
Yeah, I love that. And I think we all have have varying levels of Noreen in us. And I think I see a lot of Noreen in you also.
Oh, girl.
In terms of the persistence. So, oh, girl. Well, thank you again so much for coming on, Megan. It's been a pleasure. And thank you all so much for listening to this action-packed episode. We are going to put all of our sources on our website so you can read everything for yourself and probably come up with a few theories too. And if you are just loving this podcast and are just looking for a way to tell everyone and anyone about it, the best way to help people discover this podcast is by leaving us a 5-star rating and a review wherever you are listening right now. So make sure you follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you're wondering what we have in store for you next week, here's a quick sneak peek. Hello, everybody. It's Liam.
And I'm Alex Seda. Next week, I'm re-entering the Crime Vineyard with the story of the last man murdered on 9/11. What happened to Henrik Siwiak, and how close are we to finding that out?
We'll tell you the latest on that case next Wine Wednesday on another episode of Crime Over Wine.
Proud member of the Podnougan Network.